Welcome back to episode 121 of Rising Giants with your hosts Max Thornton and Dominic Klusik, where we explore the world of innovation and entrepreneurship in Cambodia and the Southeast Asia region, releasing a new episode every Wednesday. On this week's episode, we have Lucinda Revel. Lucinda is the co-founder of Boost Capital, a company dedicated to leveraging innovative technologies to broaden access to digital financial services, particularly for the underbanked. Through Boost's cutting-edge technology, entrepreneurs have the ability to apply for loans via chat in just 5 to 10 minutes without the need for app downloads and with the flexibility to do so from any location at any time. Lucinda's role at Boost extends beyond co-founding. She leads the charge in enhancing user experience and overseeing the implementation and management of banking partner systems. Before her journey with Boost, Lucinda served as the Chief Corporate Development Officer and Advisor to the Soma Group, one of Cambodia's leading local conglomerates comprised of 10 subsidiary companies across 6 business divisions of infrastructure, trading, agriculture, education, hospitality, and real estate. If you enjoyed the episode, be sure to like, subscribe, and leave a review on our channel as it helps us continue to grow within the region and world. And now to Lucinda.
Okay, Lucinda, welcome to Rising Giants. This is episode 117, I believe. So
good number.
Great to have you on the podcast. It's been a long time kind of keeping up to date on what you've been working on. And we've been excited to then have Boost Capital on the podcast. So welcome. And yeah, maybe just to begin with, we'd like to discuss about some of the early moments in your career that set the foundation for becoming a startup founder and the journey that you're on today.
Sure. Yeah. I think that the initial moment of getting into the career of an entrepreneur was probably, I did my MBA at INSEAD, which has a big entrepreneur focus. And it's funny because I didn't go straight into entrepreneurship from that. I went into private equity and only later sort of found my way to entrepreneurship. But I think the reason that it was impactful is it basically made entrepreneurship seem slightly less insane. Like so many people were doing it, it seemed possible. I think that when you want to be a founder, it's a bit like a leap into the abyss, you know, like so much is unknown, so much is uncertain, and having an ecosystem behind it was important. And like having other people who had lessons learned from my cohort, from my classmates, having like access to professors who could give advice was important. So basically it made it seem like less of a nutty thing to do. I think the other important thing was meeting the right co-founder. So my co-founder, Gordon, and I knew each other for like 12 years or something before we started Boost together. We also had done a project on solar together. So we knew that we were not going to kill each other either professionally or personally. And we knew that we were sort of in this together. I think that I would find it very difficult to be a solo founder. I think that that's the whole burden of the organization is on you. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of pressure. I think having a co-founder really alleviates that, and having the right co-founder really helps. So I think knowing the person that I wanted to start the company with was a key catalyst. I think if maybe I hadn't had that, I wouldn't have gone into entrepreneurship.
Yeah, actually, I think that's one thing that we notice a lot in Cambodia specifically for some reason is there are a lot of solo founders, and it can be that can be a pretty lonely journey, and just not having that many people to be motivated by, you know, ownership in the company.
Yeah.
That can be pretty tough.
Yeah, and we're pretty fluid as founders in terms of we pass a lot of roles back and forth, and it's almost kind of like you just double your manpower if you work well together. I think if I had to do everything or Gordon had to do everything on our own, we just wouldn't be able to get as much done. And then, yeah, in terms of handling the stress of it, I think it really helps.
Mm. And what was the, so you mentioned you went into private equity. What was then the moment that you kind of wanted to go down the pathway of being a founder? What was that kind of like light bulb moment?
So I have to give credit to Gordon. The idea for Boost was first his, and we were kind of chatting it over dinner. And we were talking about how it was so funny that even though we all had basically mini computers in our pockets, so much of banking in Cambodia was being done very, very manually. And it seemed like it was a missed opportunity. And he had just run a mergers and acquisitions deal in which his company at the time was selling a MFI to a Singaporean bank. Mm-hmm. And they were really proud of their app and they were like, the functionality is amazing. And Gordon said, well, what does it do? And they said, you can check your balance. And he was like, I think with where technology is, we could do more, right? Like we could make this better. And so we kind of just like, well, what would, if we were going to experiment, what would we do? And so we actually threw up a chatbot over a weekend and just sort of did a test. We put up like $50 of Facebook ads behind it, kind of just as curiosity. By the end of the weekend, there were like 500 loan applications. Fortunately, we knew somebody who owned a bank and we said, would you like customers? And they said, yeah, of course we want customers. So it just kind of went from there, right? Mm-hmm. And we built it as we went along.
And so like how long ago was that? And what is the journey? What was the early like journey like for Boost?
So that was the very end of 2018. The first, it was like December 2018, the first loan that went through our tech went through in January of 2019, right? So we were very much proponents of the concept of like build as you go along. Mm. And I think that for us, part of the, it's very important to talk to customers and to like make the user the center of the design experience. And so that has been pretty much how we grew, right? Like mm-hmm. we wanted to always be testing. We didn't want to create this perfect tech product without any touch points for the user, right? So we just built as we went.
And what was it like kind of attracting a team, raising capital, you know, was it fully kind of bootstrapping in the beginning, or what was some of the challenges there?
I think that we had a bit of an advantage in that both of us had worked in Cambodia for so long. We knew we wanted to make Cambodia our pilot market because there were a lot of reasons that it made sense to do here, that it's a market in which the concepts of credit are well established. You do have like a really good banking system. You have a really good regulator and a really good credit bureau. So all of that meant that they're doing like a digital version of that. Mm. Was not a huge leap on the point of view of like the customer experience, right? We could basically take what was working for the mm. offline and make a tech version of it. And so because of that, we already had like a network in Cambodia. All our first hires were people that either Gordon and I worked with before. And we also had, because of Gordon's prior work and my work in private equity, we knew a lot of the investors. So we had, from the very beginning, Insator Impact Fund out of Singapore gave us a convertible note to start out. So we were very lucky that from the very beginning, we had international institutional investors backing us. I think that the reason that that was useful was that they, from the very beginning, had a lot of expectations of us having procedures that were like international grade, right? So we had to meet all of their investment standards in terms of our processes or paperwork. And actually that helped us then attract right talent, right? Mm-hmm. So as we grew the team, we were saying, this is a Singapore domiciled international organization in which we are testing the technology and piloting it in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And so everybody knew that they were coming on to like an international standard team, and that helped with recruitment. Mm.
And so what was it like getting your first few like sort of customers in Cambodia? And yeah, what were some of the lessons there on how to kind of communicate that and get those customers over the line?
Yeah. So I think it's a Y Combinator principle. It's basically like always talk to your customers, right? Mm. And so for us, it was pretty easy to get the first customers because we were like really, we were deploying immediately and like building the wings on the airplane as you're flying or whatever it is, the yeah. analogy. But actually, we are a B2B2C company. And so when you, it's hard to define like, is your customer the end user or is it actually the business that is the customer? Mm. So we, for the tech build, we knew that the C part of that, like the customer experience was there from the very beginning. But then we had to also make sure that the businesses that were actually buying our product liked it as well. And so we started signing on banks mainly through network to begin with. So we knew a lot of the board members or the senior level at those organizations. And so that as like founder-led sales made sense as a starting point. I think we also, because we kind of a little bit speak bank, we understood what the impediments are for financial institution to try a new technology. Mm. And we built around that in terms of our technology and our sales process. So for example, if you ask a bank to change their credit underwriting, then they have to go through at least three committees. Mm. If you ask them to build a new tech piece, then their tech team has to build that into their pipeline. All of those things mean that you're talking about like a 2-year lead time to launch. So we structured to say, don't do any of that. Mm. Like we launched with our bank partners always with their existing loan or savings products, their existing underwriting. We don't require any tech build from them. So there's like one integration point between our tech and their technology, and it's very simple. That means risk committee doesn't have to be stressed. Credit committee doesn't have to be stressed. IT doesn't have to be stressed, right? It simplifies the sales process a lot. And that's, I think, been very crucial to us being able to grow. That being said, the cool thing about the channel, like when you have a digital channel, you start learning about your customers from the very first point that they interact with you. And you then can use that data to see like, where are people dropping? Why are they dropping? And the financial institution then can change their loan products, their savings products to meet customer demand, but based on like a data-driven approach rather than it just being more guesswork. So I think combining those two ideas that like, don't ask for too much change on the part of your customer and enable growth for them in an exciting manner, that like, that's the sales pitch.
And so what has been the reception like with Cambodia? I presume like working with the Cambodian banks and MFIs, how many of them are like ready to kind of to move forward in that direction? Or are some like more kind of more focused on like kind of pushing back on the whole digital?
Yeah, I think that because that with our technology, we can onboard all kinds of loans and savings products. So we built it so that it can accommodate collateralized loans, uncollateralized loans, group loans, savings accounts, term deposits. It means that there's we can accommodate the strategic focus of whatever their push is, right? And I think that that helps because it means that if a bank says, I want to grow my collateralized loan portfolio, we have a product for them. If they say, I want to be growing my term deposit base, we have a product for them. I think if we were only looking at like one tiny subsegment of the financial industry, it would be harder, right? Because you're like out of the strategic planning of the bank. Whereas because we have a pretty broad offering, that makes the sales easier.
And then what would you say the addressable market is? Like how many, like what are some of the things that you look for in a potential customer or client? And would you say you've kind of hit that point of you've talked to everyone in the Cambodia banking microfinance scene? Is that, yeah, I'm just curious on that.
Yeah. So our goal is basically to move into the digital channel a tenth of the portfolio of any bank, right? Yeah. Sort of fairly quickly. And so that's a huge addressable market.
Yeah.
I think also the fact that we continue to expand our product line continues to expand the customer base. So when we first launched, we were doing purely loan onboarding. Then we added financial education and then savings. And now we're adding insurance and merchant onboarding. And so all of that has sort of grown the pool of what services we can render. And helped a lot. And so there now we have clients who are actually ancillary to financial institutions like telco or merchant onboarders, that kind of thing.
Okay, I understand. And so what does the kind of expansion look like? Because, you know, as you were saying earlier, Cambodia is a great place to test out and kind of understand if you have that product market fit. But yeah, would you say that it's also, I'm just curious on like, what's the motivation for the expansion? Is that because you feel like at a certain point, the business is only going to see like further growth if they go beyond Cambodia? Or do you actually think the business would, if you just focused on Cambodia, there would be a consistent growth for many years ahead?
Great question. So our technology is always white labeled. We're building the brand of our partners. And our concept is basically pick like a handful of winners for each market and help them grow, right? Okay. But it means that we don't want to give our technology is a strategic advantage. If we work with every single financial institution in the market, then each institution that we work with doesn't get that same advantage, right? So we don't want to be working in every bank. We want to be working in the best banks, right? And the same thing with insurance, like the best providers. So we want to go regional for multiple reasons, one of which that we don't want to like super saturate the Cambodian market, but also that there are intermarket lessons learned that can be applied back and forth, right? Mm. So for example, we're doing group loan onboarding in India. Turns out also that same technology is very applicable to Indonesia and the Philippines, right? So if we try something and we sort of like pilot it in one market, we can then bring it back to another market. And like to do, for instance, term deposit onboarding in Cambodia, actually that's super helpful for the Philippines, right? And so we're trying to kind of cross-pollinate between markets. Mm. But at the same time, also understand that you need to localize the product to every market.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. No, it kind of reminds me, we just recently had support from Morricone Technology come on the podcast. And, you know, they're also going through this. I think there's some similarities in that. I think they've achieved, I would say roughly, I mean, they've achieved number one market share and working with 50 or so microfinance institutions here and some other financial institutions. And then now what they're pushing for is going to the Philippines and going to Indonesia and seeing how that product can be translated. And it's not too dissimilar,
yeah.
But there are some nuances to it. And so what's that been like, taking the team and the product to a new market? So you said the Philippines is number two and then India number three.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been really interesting. I think that there are certain differences between markets. Like for instance, we've had a ton of interest in merchant onboarding in the Philippines. Mm. And it's again, one of those cross-pollination things where we're like, oh, actually, if we develop this for the Philippines, we could bring this back to Cambodia. We could do the same thing. But sort of where there's focus differs between markets. In Cambodia, for instance, there's a lot of interest in uncollateralized salary-based lending as like a new tranche that the banks are like, oh, we'd love to go into that and we'd love to bring down our operating expenses and grow our market share in that. Digital can help. In the Philippines, huge focus on SME lending. And can we do like micro and small business lending through the digital channel? And so it's sort of like bank focus is a bit different. For us, I think that the important thing as we go multi-market though is to make sure that we still maintain enough like focus within our team, like, right, you have to have the same team camaraderie. So we still do stand-ups with each of our operating teams every single day so that we know that if there's a blocker from the management point of view, it's getting cleared on like a 24-hour basis to make sure that also our back end is more robust. Like when we first started, we were very much like cobbling together systems in the way that startups do. You know, you've got to move nimbly. And now because we're in multiple markets, we have to make sure. We had a whole project that was called Make the Back End Less Janky so that it was like easier to use by our employees in every different market. It didn't need as much like coaching along. So just making the back end more robust has been required in order to be operating in multiple markets.
And how big is the team today? Like what's your sort of headcount?
I think we're slightly over 30.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the most recent raise, maybe you can also talk about that. Like who are the new round of investors after, you know, having Incitor be on the journey for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can talk about them and kind of what they kind of were getting behind with the vision and yeah, what they're excited about for the future.
Yeah. So Incitor has been with us since the beginning. They're an impact fund. So very much part of the story is about like increasing access to finance for underbanked and unbanked. And that's been very much part of the construction of the technology. In the most recent round, we brought in a lot of international investors that sort of like a Village Global out of Silicon Valley, Iterative, they're like more tech-focused investors and more international investors and a couple of funds out of Taiwan, all with the concept that this would now go regional. And so for the new investor base, it's very much about how do you achieve growth? How do you achieve scale across markets?
Mm. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And when you talk to these investors and you discuss kind of what you're building, do they see a lot of this in the region already? Or is it like how many other competitors would you say you have on the regional side?
Like for direct competitors in our technology?
Yeah.
Great question. we find that our differentiation points are that, one, we are very financial institution focused. So there are other people who are doing technology in chat, but they don't necessarily make it for banks. And so they're more general chat service providers. And when they try and make a product particularly for banks, it's kind of like they start at zero. They don't understand how to speak bank. They don't understand bank needs. And so it's fairly easy to compete against that, because we're saying this provider is going to take 12 months to launch with you. We will launch with you in 2 weeks because we already have the systems. So we consider that to be like not direct competition. There are also some companies that do sort of digitization of whole bank backends. But again, these rollouts take like 2 years and they require so many resources on the part of the bank, because they're really talking about like changing whole systems that sit behind banking and digitizing them. Again, we're like, we take 2 weeks. So the lift is a lot lighter for us to, for a bank to choose to work with Boost than for a lot of our competitors. And we find that's quite helpful.
And so maybe looking out into 2024, what's your, I guess, what's the kind of current customer count and what are you kind of aiming to get to with this regional expansion?
Yeah. I mean, we're basically looking at 10xing our customer base.
Yeah.
And we're doing it kind of across, I guess, three different matrices. So we're adding more product lines, right? So now we do loan onboarding, savings onboarding, financial education. Now we're adding merchant onboarding and we're adding insurance. So more product for people to buy, more geographies, right? So we're going into different regions, and then also more types of customers. So we're, instead of just focusing on, for instance, like we first started at whether our main customers being microfinance institutions, we then discovered actually there was a ton of interest for the technology amongst commercial banks. So now we went microfinance, commercial banks. Now we're adding insurance providers, telco, merchant onboarders, right? So we're accessing a larger base of customers, both geographically and in terms of sector.
Okay. And it, by the way, is it just curious question here, is like, is there a certain size that a bank gets to that they just decide to do all this in-house? Or is it like, because it's interesting, we recently had a guy called Harpram from Easy Digital come on the podcast, and he's basically trying to digitize and help digitize on the insurance side of things, on the brokers and the agents and all the kind of the online systems involved in that, like transitioning it away from paper. But I think what one thing he was mentioning is that, you know, when some insurance companies get to a certain size, they try and like do all that internally. But of course, it takes them such a long time.
Yeah.
Because it's not their like specialty. But I'm just curious if you see that as well. On once you get to that certain size, they would not be outsourcing.
Yeah, they sort of make that buy versus build decision. Yes, we see that. It's actually one of the best kind of customers for us is a bank that's tried to do it. And it's funny, there's a particular case I can think of a bank where we presented our technology and they said, interesting. And then they disappeared for 6 months and they came back and they said, so we tried to build it. That was a disaster. And then they hired us, right? Because there's a lot of art to what we do. There are a lot of systems that sit around the chat in order to maximize the customer funnel. There's a lot of like A/B testing that we've been doing over multiple years to like maximize the experience. So what we find is basically if a bank tries to do it themselves, maybe out of 100 people who start a chat, they might get 10 customers out of it. Whereas if we do it with our system, you get 95 customers out of it, right? There's a huge difference. And so conveying to banks that it's harder than they think is important, right? To say like, this is not going to be as easy as you think it's going to be. And to give them a lot of examples, like I can point to banks that have tried to do what we've done and then been banned from Facebook because they violate the rules of Meta and things like that. So giving them real use cases about how hard it would be for them to build it themselves.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you just mentioned about like kind of the social media juggernauts. So are you mostly working with Meta, or there are other social media companies that you also look to work with?
So we work in Messenger, Telegram, WhatsApp, we're adding Viber line. So we try and pick the most popular chat channel for any particular market. So for example, in India, it's WhatsApp versus in Cambodia, it's Messenger and Telegram. And then we fit into that channel, right? We also, because we interface with the marketing departments of each of the financial institutions, end up seeing a lot of like what works in terms of digital marketing. But we try and be a little bit like channel agnostic. The technology works with whatever chat channel is the most popular. But we just want to make sure that we're meeting the customer, the end customer, like the financial institution customer, wherever they are. We don't ever want the end customer to have to learn a new piece of technology or download a new app in order to access the financial service. Because as soon as you put a barrier to entry in front of them, it becomes, your reach is limited.
Mm. And what about TikTok? Is that also used for these kinds of things?
Yeah. So for marketing a lot. So it depends on the market, but sometimes it's more popular, sometimes it's less. Mainly it's like a referral channel. Mm. So with our tech, we can basically accommodate both online and offline entry point, right? So like either it's that somebody sees a TikTok ad or they see a Facebook ad and they click the button and they start a chat with the bank, or they can even see an offline ad. So like a QR code, right? Mm. And so a lot of our banks actually use QR codes to enable agents to refer customers to them. And that's as much a popular channel as the digital channel. And the cool thing is that it's all traceable. So the marketing departments for the banks really like it because they can actually figure out what's more effective. Is it TikTok? Is it Facebook ads? Is it mall promotions? Like they can see where all the customers are coming from.
Right. Okay. Mm. And maybe just also touching a bit more on your experience overall being a founder. You mentioned about what it's like to be like a female entrepreneur and also in, I guess, in Cambodia, we see a lot more of that today, I think. But when you got going, I'm sure that was not as common to see. So I maybe just would be interested to hear what that experience has been like.
Mm, yeah. I think that for me, it's really important to be part of a female founder ecosystem. Mm. So some of our early investors were actually focused on female founders, like Epic Angels out of Singapore invested in us. They're a consortium of female investors trying to focus on female founders. Women's World Banking, we did a lot of work with very early on about access to finance for women. So like really being part of a community and then using it to sort of construct the right support systems within your own institution is important. So like for Boost, our board is gender balanced. Our senior management team is gender balanced. The head of product for us in Cambodia is a woman. Our head of partner management is a woman. So, and we also have like a mentoring program for our female entrepreneurs. Mm. So really making sure that like you build the right support systems in order to grow your own like in-house talent pool to make sure that you're creating the right sort of environment for women to like themselves one day become female entrepreneurs.
And I'm just curious, now that you're, you know, a regional company, how does Cambodia like compare in terms of gender in the workplace versus somewhere like the Philippines?
I've got to give Cambodia credit in a lot of ways. Like, so I've lived in Cambodia for, I think it's like 16 years now or something like that. And there's a reason I've stuck around so long, right? It's a really interesting work environment. I think it's actually a work environment that is very positive for women. Like there's so many just high powered women like who run businesses in this country. I used to work for Soma Group. Yeah. Their CEO is named Krasna Cham. She's like full high-powered, running a conglomerate woman, right? Mm. So I actually think that it's really quite enabling here. The NBC is helmed by women. So many different businesses are run by women here. I think that it's been an environment that very much fosters growth for female founders.
That's great. Okay, that's great to hear. I do think, of course, in the VC and private equity space, it's, you know, it's heavily, heavily skewed. I mean, but it's changing for sure. But at least in Southeast Asia, it's great to hear of. We've heard a lot about Epic Angels.
Mm-hmm.
But
they run a podcast.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Yeah. But no, I think there's a lot more that could be done on the investor side as well.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, it hasn't quite seen that, like that shift, I would say.
Yeah. There's some cool investors out there that are doing gender lens investing. Mm. One that comes to mind, didn't invest in Boost, but Tasia Ventures. There are some that are really trying to like focus on female founders as a inherent part of their investment strategy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's kind of the goals for, I guess, the next few years? You want to, like, you're going to be shifting into three markets in total. If we were to have a podcast in 3 years' time, where would you like to kind of be in terms of fundraising, growth, et cetera?
Yeah, more markets. So we're probably going to go into Indonesia next. We're probably going to fundraise again in 2025 in order to fund additional market growth.
Mm.
So I think definitely growing in Southeast Asia, South Asia. And then we'd like to take the technology to Africa and Latin America. So the way that people want to access financial services in both of those markets, they would love to go digital. And I think that if we have the bandwidth to take on all those new markets, we would.
Okay. And what do you think would, like, looking out onto this, you know, this growth and this, you know, what you're seeing, what do you think are going to be some of the biggest challenges that you'll encounter for the next few years? What are some things you're trying to navigate?
I think that it's always a challenge to decide how much you want in terms of your team to be in market versus have the efficiencies and economies of scale of having sort of like a more centralized team. And so our principle is that we should always have a product expert in every market who can help us localize and understand market demand, but that maybe some of our tech talent should be centralized. So our developers are based out of Europe, not Asia, because we've been able to find really good talent there. And also just having a team that's a bit more centralized and able to work collaboratively and work with each other. But then making sure that you have to have a product person who understands local market demand is important. And like making sure you navigate that combination can be a challenge, right? Because how do you make sure that you understand local market demand without having to lose some of the economies of scale of having a centralized team?
Mm. And where in Europe do you have your team?
So we originally hired our developers out of the Ukraine. This was back in 2019 before there was a war in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
And so now some of our developers actually moved out of the Ukraine. So Poland, Lithuania, UK. And then I think we just hired another developer out of the UK. So we've been finding good developer talent there too.
Mm. Okay. And so, but then the whole development team all kind of, like, they all work, I guess, on a relatively similar time zone, right? So they can all kind of work well together.
Yeah, but then I think also in the startup world, you just end up having like crazy hours, you know, like regardless of where you are, like everybody has to be able to have like a more flexible work schedule. And so when we have product people based in Asia, the developer team might like work early in the morning or later at night, and our product team does too, right? We just try and be flexible to make sure that we get the job done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. And what you also mentioned about the recent expansion and having a GM in the Philippines already. What have been some of those kind of initial hurdles that you've had to get over with working with your first few handful of customers and kind of getting that expansion like on the pathway that you wanted to be on?
So I guess our expansion pathway hasn't so much had hurdles based on geography as just velocity. Like we want to grow really fast, and then you have to have systems that accommodate that, right? So I think that we've been transitioning from really founder-led sales focus, where we were very much like Gordon and I were pitching every single financial institution, to having a little bit more of a team supporting that, right? So we've hired BD team members who are based in each market and able to do all of the follow-ups and the preparation of materials, right? So like if we have a really big bank that we want to land, we try and tailor the pitch to them, understand exactly what they need, their needs are in advance. Somebody needs to be doing that research. Somebody needs to be creatively thinking and talking to the product team to be like, how should we exactly tailor this experience for the bank? So that's been building that capacity has been the sort of, we realized what we needed to do in order to grow as fast as we want.
Right. Yeah. No, I guess if it's just the two of you doing the sales, I mean, I guess how many potential clients do you have at any one point in time?
If it was only the two of us, not that many, right? Yeah. That's why we need more people. And it's funny, some financial institutions make their decisions fast. Mm. Like they see the tech, they just say, yeah, we want this. And then next week they're signing a contract. Some of them take like 6 months to make the decision because they have very precise roadmaps for what they want to be doing in terms of their tech development. And we have to make sure that we fit into that. And like, you have to be answering the RFP at the right time, right? And so we need team members that look after those sort of like more slow moving ones so that we stay top of mind in their procurement process.
Right. And how important would you say is the in-person interaction as well?
With the bank or the financial institutions? Mix. I mean, it really depends. I think that one of the advantages of COVID having happened is that a lot of people just got used to remote and it became more of an acceptable channel. And so I think for both sales and like customer support, a lot of it now is being done remotely and that's fine. I think what gets lost when you try and do just remote and it's better to be in person is some of the like creative thinking or like hearing them gripe about a problem, right? Because when you're in a meeting, you don't necessarily get everybody like and it's a virtual meeting. You don't have that sort of chit chat. Whereas when you actually spend time with people in person, you learn a little bit more about different opportunities, right? And so, like I mentioned before, we're now doing merchant onboarding for the Philippines. The only reason that we realized that was an opportunity is because we were in the Philippines, we're talking to people who are a bit like ancillary to our core offering and understanding what their pain points are and then being like, oh, actually, like our technology can, we can help with that, right? Mm. And if we weren't on the ground, we'd miss those opportunities.
Right, right. No, I think, yeah, I think the point you make about, you know, I think it's great that everyone got used to it, but when I compare like an in-person meeting versus like, it would probably take three like Zoom meetings to get to know someone. Like you feel like you've kind of got to know them a bit more deeply versus an hour of in person.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. In person is much better for a new relationship. Mm. Whereas if you already have an existing relationship, then you can just move it to virtual and sort of have as many efficiencies. But I do actually feel a great deal of like sympathy for anybody who is trying to start their career in the middle of the pandemic.
Oh, wow.
Because you can't build your network. Whereas if you already have a network, you can maintain it virtually.
Yes. No, I do. Yeah. I really do feel sorry for the people. Yeah. The people that graduated at that time. And yeah. And also the people that had to do their, you know, their, all of their classes all on Zoom. And yeah, that kind of thing is just, very tough.
But I think it's also helpful to have some established networks that help you network. So like, for example, I did my MBA at INSEAD. The alumni community is in every country. Mm. And so I was just in Manila. I had a coffee with an alum. He posted to their WhatsApp group about how I was in town. And I had like 10 additional BD meetings based on that, right?
Wow.
So just leveraging networks and leveraging communities, whether or not you're in person or virtual, can be very helpful.
Yeah, I feel like INSEAD is definitely one of those like MBAs and also that has a really big presence all over the world, right? I mean, I guess being, because they're two, as you said, they're two campuses is Paris and Singapore, right?
Yeah, and now I think they have something in Abu Dhabi or something. Oh. They've got somebody in the Middle East too.
Yeah, great. Well, yeah, just kind of moving into the last part of the podcast where we talk more about like kind of the interpersonal side of things. Who have been some of your key like mentors, if any, like along the way?
I think that my co-founder, I guess, is a big one. I think that my natural personality is a little bit curmudgeonly and a little bit maybe insular. And Gordon is just he's so emotionally supportive to people. He's so open and caring and lovely. And so I think he pushes me a little bit to be like a better manager, a better communicator. So I really appreciate working with him. I think other people who have tried to be both parents and business owners and like seeing what does and doesn't work for them. So like not marquee names of this person's like a mentor for me, but just people who, my friends who are trying to navigate the same dynamics. Like I have three children and then Boost is my fourth child. And how do you balance those two? Some people do an awesome job at it. Some people crash and burn on it, right? It's not easy to balance your personal life and your business life. So friends of mine who have managed to navigate that well are definitely mentors for me.
Yes, that's great. And what would you say some of your like key habits are that keep you motivated and, you know, having the energy that you have to get up every day and go for it with Boost?
Besides coffee?
Yeah.
I think that, like I was saying, it's a bit of a challenge to navigate how do you have a personal life and a professional life that are both flourishing. I think that I have a habit of trying to integrate them a little bit. So like I've got a 12-year-old and two 10-year-olds, they're twins, and I ask them to test our product all the time. Like if a 10-year-old can manage financial service onboarding, then you pretty much are sure that everyone can manage it. So, and like if they get bored and they drop off, that's an indicator to me. So it's trying to sort of like interface different components of your life to keep it exciting is important. I think also it's nice that there's so much interesting learning happening in the space that that our business is in, right? So like we've now integrated natural language processing and AI in multiple points of what we do. Like we use it for document analysis, we use it for customer servicing, we have it integrated in our chatbot. So like having the opportunity to be at the forefront of so much tech development, I think it's impossible to be bored with that.
Right. Okay. That's a good way to think about it. And yeah, having your children test the product and see if it can kind of pass that test.
Yeah, the 10-year-old test.
Right. Yeah, so just coming to the end, our traditional closing question we like to ask all of our guests is, what would you say is the most important piece of advice that you've ever been given?
My father would like me to say, always pack a bathing suit. You never know when there's going to be a pool. That's probably not life-changing, though. I think always talk to your customer. And also, don't spend a ton of expensive developer time building a product until you're sure that there is a buyer for it. So I think that a lot of entrepreneurs, like tech entrepreneurs, try and build this beautiful tech experience. And only once it's built do they put it into the wild. And then they discover that nobody wants to use it or nobody buys it, right? So to try and actually, I guess like you call it like Wizard of Oz, your product as much as possible. When you're still trying to figure out if you have product market fit, when you're trying to develop your minimum viable product, try and vaporware as much as possible. So for example, when we were trying to figure out, was there a demand for eKYC from the banks? We didn't actually build eKYC. What we did is we had human operators calling customers, looking at their ID card, recording the experience, making sure that we were verifying identity. And then once it became clear that, oh, actually banks did want that, we built the tech components behind it. And now it's an automated system. It uses facial recognition. It uses liveness detection, all these things. But we only built it once we knew there was demand for it. And like, we're not perfect. Like, there's plenty of stuff that we've built and then it turned out that we didn't use. But as much as possible, the principle I think that entrepreneurs need to go with is like, make sure there is demand before you spend a ton of investment on making the perfect product behind it.
Right. No, I think that's very good advice for the founders listening in. Great. Well, on that note, thanks very much, Lucinda, for coming on Rising Giants. It's been interesting discussion on, learned a lot about the financial sector and everything that you're doing to enable more technology there.
Yeah. And if I can make one additional point, I think that for advice for entrepreneurs, if you are in a situation in which you're trying to raise capital and you're trying to decide who you want to focus on. If you have investors who themselves were once operators, they're the best. They give you the best advice. They have practical network that they can bring in on your behalf. So try and find investors who themselves were once entrepreneurs. Their advice will be super valuable.
Great. Yeah, I think that's something that we see a bit more of, I think, in the region as time goes on, as there's more like that, more flywheel of founders turned investors. Great. Well, thanks again for taking the time, and looking forward to keeping up to date on all the progress of Boost Capital.
Thanks very much.